I guess we're not allowed to stream that. You don't have to hide. Goo just stood beside me, man. It was fine. It wasn't that hard. Just stood here. We were friendly and everything. It's okay. Yeah. No, it can be easy. It really can be easy. I'm trying to figure out, I don't know, I've known the guy for 15 years now, something horrible like that. Yes, well, and boy, your arms are tired. I just got off a plane from Africa. So we're having competitions for who flew further to get here. I came from Cape Town, South Africa, got here on Sunday. Norway, yesterday. Okay. You got hemisphere issues, I think, but I've had a few more days than you to recover, though, so we were together in Amsterdam for that. We've done our first dev intersection ever in Europe was 2 weeks ago, so we were together there. My friend Scott Hanselman. I got a couple of housekeeping things to do, too, but you throw me up. Yeah, big hand for Scott Hanselman. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I don't want their pity applause now. Oh, he's jet lagged.
Thanks so much for coming out. Have you had a great conference so far? Busy day yesterday? Yes. Normally we don't reschedule an awful lot of sessions, but Mr. Rob Eisenberg had flight delays and was unable to do his session yesterday afternoon. We've actually rescheduled that. It's the web component session. So if you're hoping to see Rob in action, 11:45 a.m. today, in Grand Ballroom 123 will be that session moved up, so you'll be able to catch that session, and he has another one right after it, so we're making him work harder. But we got that one fixed, so if you were missing out on your Rob Eisenberg time, that's handled. What else do we need to know? Tonight, the Native Script Hackathon, that's the Telerik folks are putting that on, so if you're interested in checking out what Native Script's all about, great opportunity to take a good look at that. Obviously a huge roster of sessions going over the course of today. Mr. Hanselman will be moderating a panel discussion at 3:45 this afternoon right back here with a number of Microsoft luminaries and other troublemakers. I'm not even sure.
Jason Zander will be there. He just texted me. He's getting on an airplane.
Nice. So Mr. Zander will be there. It'll be good fun. And other than that, I think I'm just going to get out of your way. Keep doing what you're doing. We're happy. We're excited to see folks tweeting to us and writing comments on the event board app to let us know what sessions you're happy with, what we'd like to change. We're always trying to make the show better. We've committed to being back here next year, the last week of October, back at the MGM Grand. And one of the things we're going to focus on, and in fact, if you will register early for next year's show, we are offering Oculus Rifts. If you sign up, we're going to probably do a whole track on that. I think virtual reality's taken a hold, and so time to start experimenting with that stuff. So if you register us for next year on Oculus Rift, you can take it, get it before Christmas.
So now you've just made everyone who's here now feel bad.
No, they got goodies this year too.
Okay.
So everybody got goodies, man.
Oh, I'll be back next year then. I'm going to get a Rift.
Mr. Hanselman laid his hand on a Surface Book this morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Now hates his computer.
The Surface Book, I touched the Surface Books, and it is so thin that now my Surface 3 offends me. It's unacceptably thick, and right. I cannot even stand to look at the thing.
Too much.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to get out of your way. My friend Scott Hanselman, enjoy the morning.
All right. Cool, thanks. So, wow, is that as loud as it is in my head? Because it seems a little loud. I think it's a little loud. That's how the sound guy will know. Ah, there you go. Thanks, everybody. Cool. So my name is Scott, and I want to talk about what an open source Microsoft web platform looks like. Some of you have probably seen talks like this before, but I'm trying to bring you some new stuff, some new ideas, and do a lot more demos than I usually do, although I usually do a whole lot of demos. But one of the things that this talk usually does is it sets context. It gives you an idea of why we did what we're doing and what direction we're going. Some of you may have been here a couple, 3 or 4 years ago when we talk about things like OneASP.NET. We'll see that happened and we're moving forward with that. We've seen early versions of ASP.NET 5 when we called it .NET vNext. But we're also seeing a fundamental shift in how Microsoft and the Microsoft web platform is shaped and how we do open source. So I got a whole bunch of cool stuff to show you, and hopefully it'll give you some context. One little bit of interesting context that I realized that I've been doing .NET since 2002, which means I'm super old, but I've also been doing .NET open source since 2002, and in fact, people don't realize this, but my blog runs on DOSBlog, which is German for the blog. That's how good my German is. This was actually .NET 2.0 until last year, and I got teased about it. People were like, why are you still running .NET 2? And I remind people that, well, because it works just fine. Because it comes with Windows, and it works totally fine. And upgrading to .NET 3.5 is trivial. And in fact, I upgraded it to .NET 4.5 a couple of months ago with my friend Mark Downey, and it only took us about 3 hours to upgrade the thing. But there's no reason I didn't really need to upgrade it. .NET 2 works fine. And I say that because I think people don't realize sometimes when they go in Visual Studio 2015 and they go file new project, that you don't have to pick the latest and greatest shiny thing. You can go and edit and work on .NET 2 applications. So I actually did the upgrade in Visual Studio 2015. I was editing and working on a .NET 2 application, which was my blog, which, by the way, is now on GitHub. So, you know, it's cool. New and shiny is cool, but also, you know, you have a whole range of tools in your toolkit that you can potentially use, and you don't necessarily have to use the new and shiny thing. So open source is evolving, and it's not just at Microsoft. Everywhere, there are conversations where bosses and suit-type people are sitting around thinking about maybe it's time to do open source. The same kind of people who find themselves wondering if HTML5 is a fad or not. And they're sitting around going, you know, is open source really going to work out? Is that a thing? But I absolutely think that it is. You should ignore it at your peril. If you're sitting in a room that's burning and you're like, this is fine, this is good, then you're probably going to fail. Putting open source into your strategy is a good idea. In 2002, 3, 4, 5, back in the day there, almost 10 years ago plus, I was working at a retail online banking place, and we were doing .NET, and we were introducing open source into large retail banks. So this is 10 years ago. So if your company is saying, well, I don't really think we can use open source, then that's kind of a problem. But I'm also going to talk about how the open source that we ship with Visual Studio, the open source that we ship as ASP.NET, is a Microsoft-supported product. So you don't have to go necessarily and get permission to use it because Microsoft stands behind it. And we'll talk about the different levels of involvement that you can get into. So blah, 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 marketing. I'm just going to skip past all the ones with people. Here's a really cool article about our plans to open source .NET. You might notice the date. Yeah. You know we did this before? We've actually done it 3 different times, it turns out. I'm hoping it will take this time. We actually gave away the code to .NET in 2001, and it was called Rotor, R-O-T-O-R. Except we gave it a weird license. We called it shared source, and it was like shared academic source. And then we took all the good stuff out. We took out the jitter and the garbage collector, and we made those academic, simpler versions of the garbage collector and the jitter, and basically gave it to people in computer science to study. And then later on, we did the .NET reference source. Actually, a lot of people don't realize that you can go up to sourceof.NET. Did you know that? It's a really cool URL, sourceof.NET, and that'll take you up here. This is really useful. Most people don't know that this exists. So here's system.web, and I can go around and look at the actual source code of .NET. And in fact, see comments, and there's all sorts of swear words and good stuff in there. And you can even link to a specific line of code. So you see, if I wanted to email someone about a line of code in the .NET framework at work, I could say, yeah, I'm pretty sure it works like this. I know you're probably using Reflector or something like that to look at the source, but sourceof.NET, you can do that, and then you can even link to it and say, yeah, line 30 says that this is how it works. And it's totally searchable. It's very cool. But that was done as a reference source license, right, which was one of those look but don't touch licenses. It wasn't really open source as it was source opened. See, it's open source. No, don't touch it. You can't touch it, but you can look at it. It's cool. See? Now it's real, although some snarky newspapers are still saying, like, oh, it'll be different this time, honest. I think it's been proven to be different this time already, and I'll give you some statistics to prove why it is. blah, 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 marketing, marketing, blah, blah, blah. There are thousands, 6,000, 7,000 forks. I need to update these numbers. There's thousands of pull requests. .NET open source on GitHub is doing really, really well, not just ASP.NET, but also .NET Core. This is an interesting chart here. If you look on the left there, it says contribution by group. So 20% of the contributions to .NET are coming from outside, from the community, not just from the people who work at Microsoft. And this is really cool, but at the same time, it does make some people uncomfortable because they still wonder about quality and security and all those kinds of things. But because all source runs through the exact same repository, whether I checked something in or did a pull request or whether you did a pull request, it's going to run through the exact same quality gates, the exact same security gates, the exact same what they call polycheck or globalization checks that we do with anything. So by the time it ships, it is the Microsoft-supported version of something. A good example is some people who runs Chrome, Google Chrome, okay, a lot of people, who runs Chromium? Right, like three or four. Chromium is the open source project that feeds into Google Chrome. Right, you don't get support for Chromium because it's an open source project, but you do get support for Chrome because Chromium is the Google Chrome branded version of that. So there's ASP.NET open source, but then there's ASP.NET that has been licensed to you when you have a copy of Visual Studio, and that's a real Microsoft product, and then all of the open source that ships within it is licensed similarly. So you can choose to think about this as open or as closed as you want to, and I'm actually going to give you a couple of diagrams in a few minutes to explain that. This chart talks about six different projects that are happening in .NET open source, but they interestingly clustered up. On the left, you've got this bunch of projects that became immediately popular and huge amounts of contributions. You've got Roslyn, which is the C# and VB open source compilers, the Core FX, the .NET Core framework, and then you've got the Core CLR, the runtime itself. Those are all clustered in the super popular, we love it, this is exciting, section of the graph there. And then the other ones is Model View Controller, the Entity Framework, which is the database stuff, and then the DNX, which is the .NET execution environment. And they're all clustered around at the bottom there. So I'm trying to figure out why that is. Why do those things cluster like that? And no one's been able to give me a good answer, but the answer that I think is the right answer is that compilers and frameworks and CLRs are fun and computer science-y and academic, and they represent a significant challenge. People want to get .NET running on FreeBSD or on a PlayStation 2 or something like that, right? There's someone out there, somewhere out there, there's a 12-year-old girl in Norway who's trying to get it to work on a PlayStation 2 for no other reason than that would be awesome. Right, and that's what the promise of open source compilers and open source frameworks and stuff. We've got people putting these on Raspberry Pis and all sorts of different devices. That's, I think, less fun than web frameworks, which are just really, I mean, what is a web framework, right? It's a thing to make strings and angle brackets and curly braces. So while I think both have seen significant uptick, I think that the academic aspect of doing compilers and open source frameworks that can run anywhere have got more people excited. That's my theory. I'd be interested in your theory. Now, there's a website called .net.github.io. If we click on that, this is one of those websites that's really amazing that no one actually ever goes to. And if we go over there, it is going to be a whole bunch of repositories. These are all the different repositories within the .NET organization. And I can zoom in on them and see not just things like the Entity Framework, but also we have an LLVM compiler that people don't know about, a Mono implementation of system.drawing. Here's Orchard, which is a free content management system. And you can hover over these. There's WCF. All this stuff that people didn't realize was open sourced. You can see how popular they are, how many issues are going on. And there's pages and pages of this stuff. There's 30 different repositories. And in fact, I have to keep updating the statistics because it goes up every day. So this is actually out of date, and that's a little bit newer. So 20,000 forks. The best part about having .NET and open source is the number of forks. And I think it's because people don't trust us to not take it back. So whenever anyone sees something cool in .NET, they're like, ooh, fork it quick before Microsoft takes it away. But of course, we're not going to do that because that's not how we roll anymore. Okay, so ASP.NET 5. Now here are the diagrams where you're going to want to take pictures of this and then show it to your bosses. And there's a couple of build slides here that explain what's going on, and then we'll do some demos. So ASP.NET 4.6, it's out, it's released, it's what we call RTM, right? Release to manufacturing, and that runs on top of the .NET framework 4.6, okay? ASP.NET runs on the full framework, and the full framework runs on Windows. It uses the .NET framework libraries, but then underneath, there's all that new stuff that we talked about. The compiler, the Roslyn compiler, is now released and open source. You've got the new jitter, what's called the Ryu JIT. It's a 64-bit jitter that's smart about modern processors. And all of those runtime components actually are new, even though they're underneath. We've swapped the brain out of .NET and replaced it with better brains. So your ASP.NET 4 or 4.5 applications could upgrade to 4.6, continue to run in the full framework, it's all released, and you're going to get the benefits of things like Roslyn. So if you're a web forms developer, you can go to the web dev blog and read about how we've enabled the latest versions of C# and those new C# features in your web forms apps. Lots of cool stuff going on in web forms. In fact, you've got asynchronous model binding and C# sevenisms and stuff. There's also hundreds of new improvements in WPF, and the full framework means just that. It is the entire .NET framework, and it runs on just on Windows. Here's where things get a little confusing. So if we split this, ASP.NET 5 also can run on .NET Framework 4.6. It runs on the full framework and it runs on Windows. And this is kind of our one ASP.NET promise, where we've got a unified framework where MVC and web APIs live together. But what's important to note is that these are two different versions of ASP.NET. This is what we call a reboot of the platform, but they both run on .NET 4.6. Okay, here's where it gets a little confusing, and that's why we're going to want to take pictures of that. See how ASP.NET 5 just spread apart across both the full framework and the core framework. So you've got .NET Core 5 over there. That's the core fundamental bits of the .NET framework. It doesn't include everything that the full framework that .NET 4.6 includes, but it does run on Mac and Linux and Windows. ASP.NET 5, right, the next version of ASP.NET. Who saw Damian Edwards' intros yesterday on ASP.NET 5? A couple people? Good. Oh, I will show you a few things because some of you didn't see that. ASP.NET 5 runs on top of .NET Core 5 and on top of the full framework simultaneously. You can pick one or the other. And what this means is if you are just running Windows at your work, you have a good experience with .NET Framework 4.6, maybe start exploring ASP.NET 5, and you can continue to run it the same way as before. You get choice with ASP.NET 5. In fact, when you go over to Visual Studio, and you have a new project here, see how we've got this .NET execution environment, the DNX 4.51 and Core 5 simultaneously under references. We're actually targeting both. So when you make a new ASP.NET application and you build it, it actually builds twice. It's all building twice against both frameworks, and there's a thing called Unified IntelliSense. So if I go into, let's go into Home Controller, and let's see if this is restored. I'm going to just hit Restore Packages. And that is going to run the NuGet restore stuff and get everything lined back up again. And if not, I'll make a new project. Notice that these are all coming out of NuGet. These little icons here are indicating that Entity Framework came from NuGet. And let's go and say thread system dot threading dot, here we go. See how some of those have a little bang by them, a little yield sign, indicating that they aren't available in both places. So as you're writing your code, you'll get this unified IntelliSense that'll tell you whether or not something is going to be available on the framework that you want. So here it's saying, well, apartment state is a COM thing, right? Apartment state is com, so it's not available on Linux. It's not available on Mac, so it's not available in the .NET Core framework. And unified IntelliSense shows you that. So you get this choice then, how do you want to work around that? And you can use like an if def, right? If definition and say, if defined, full framework, use this, else, use that. Another big example would be system.drawing, right? That is something that is not available on Mac because it's a Win32 thing, right? So that's not something that's going to work everywhere. So we only have things on the .NET Core that would work everywhere. The registry, right? The registry doesn't exist on a Mac. So how are you going to talk to the registry on .NET Core? So .NET Core is pared down to its essence. These are released. You see it says RTM, release to manufacturing, which is funny because there's no manufacturing, right? It's just bits, but we call it manufacturing. There's some bit factory out there. So those are all released, and those are all open source. So all of ASP.NET is open source, and all the stack of the .NET Core 5, the libraries, the compilers, is all open source. Not source opened, open source. And that's really important to point out. I want to talk about some of the goals, and then we'll do a little bit of an overview, and we'll start doing some crazy stuff. This is why we did it. This is why we felt the need to reboot ASP.NET. We needed a modular framework out there. People were looking at web forms and saying that it's not as fast as Node or it's not as fast as Framework X. But they were also comparing, in my opinion, minivans and motorcycles. Web forms is an amazing thing, and it lets you do rich dashboards and use this huge ecosystem of controls for building enterprise dashboards. In fact, people don't realize that web forms is actually about 2 to 3% faster than MVC out of the box. Everyone assumes that that's not the case. There's actually more going on in MVC than in web forms. Web forms is actually faster. But if you go and do raw throughput, right, you make a file new project, default.aspx, and you say response.write hello world, you're going to find that that's kind of slow because that's not the job of something like web forms, right? If you go do that in MVC, you've got all of the controllers and the routing and the things that make MVC MVC, and you're going to see that that's also not going to be competitive, especially when you go and do a benchmark against a C++ tiny little benchmark application whose job it is to be super fast. You also want more choice. People have been saying that less and SAS and gulp and grunt and this CSS library or that JavaScript library are all coming out and they want choice. They want a modular framework. Let's talk about benchmarks for a second. If I go up to github.com/ASP.NET/benchmarks, there is a thing called the Tech Empower benchmarks. Maybe you've seen these. This is one of the ones that's kind of always used against us. They are a cool bunch of folks that go and do multiple rounds of benchmarking, and they try lots of different frameworks. Some of them are very obscure, some of them are not. This is a plain text response where we're just saying basically hello world, right? And you can see there's something called ulib that does 7 million requests a second, which is amazing. And then as you move your way down, there's a bunch of stuff that you haven't heard of. And then you see Go, right? The Go language, 800,000, that's awesome. Here's Node, 300,000, right? PHP, 200,000. So this is called the long tail, right? I mean, these are not necessarily for production, but we, ASP.NET, have always been at the bottom for a couple of reasons. One, this is a Linux benchmark, and they haven't got a Windows thing set up. But also because we haven't really paid attention to this because we've been focused on making a really productive framework for websites. But now we have a system that is modular enough that we think you could both do really well on the benchmark and make really amazing applications. So we're going to try to get in the top 10 there. not the top, like, 100. So let's go look at our benchmarks. And this is all happening in the open. This is our playground that Damien's working on with a bunch of folks. And you can talk about the different systems that we've got and our baselines and blah, blah, blah. So here is ASP.NET 4.6 doing about 60,000 requests a second. Classic ASP.NET 4.6. Here's Node on the same machine doing 100,000. And then here's ASP.NET 5 using Kestrel, which is the new web application server that we're going to use on ASP.NET 5, and it's doing okay. But if we turn on HTTP pipelining, we can see on the same machines we're doing better than Node in that case, four times better, getting almost 500,000 requests a second, which is pretty good. But this is talking Kestrel, and we're spending a lot of time in the CPU. We think that we can go from about 500,000 upwards. We've actually had a community member did some work on a thing called registered IO, and this is just a benchmark. This is not a web server. It's not ASP.NET. This is just a C# custom socket server that answers HTTP, but he's got 6 million requests a second. Now, libuv is what is underlying Node. We can do 2.4 million a second with libuv. We think we can get ASP.NET 5 in the million to a million and a half range, sometime next year, which would put us theoretically squarely in the top or close to the top 10. And this is, though, the modular framework, right? This is about picking the pieces that you want, right? This isn't ASP.NET with session. This is raw ASP.NET. This is the ability to have an ASP.NET that is going to be both a minivan and a motorcycle. You pick the pieces that you want. If you want to turn on static file handling, you turn it on. If you want to turn off session, you remove the concept entirely. It's completely modular. And if you don't like something that we did, then that's cool. You remove it entirely. Okay? Blah, 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 blah. I'm blah, blah, blahing past all the boring stuff. Let's even do that. Let's scroll past the boring stuff. This is all boring. Oh, this is cool. Let's do this. So speaking of choice, there's a lot of different frameworks that people want to be able to use, and we want to enable them, but we want to do it in a way that doesn't freak out our base, right? You are our base. You know, you're trying to get real work done. Maybe you're not interested in keeping up on the latest and greatest hot new thing. Or maybe you are, but just not at work, right? You want to do Angular, and you want to do less and SAS and all those things, but your boss isn't letting you do that. So you're having to live in one foot in both worlds. We want ASP.NET to be able to satisfy the enterprise boss as well as the startup that you have going on the side. We want to make it so if you don't want to go to the command line to edit some JavaScript file, you don't have to. You'll spend your time in Visual Studio. But maybe you don't even like Visual Studio. You want to do something else. Remember we said modularity, right? Remember that? So who's played with OmniSharp? OmniSharp.net. See, I love it when people haven't, because I feel like when you give a talk, you know, you want to give as much information as you can. I have an hour. But I want to give information that's going to cause you to go back to, like, immediately after the talk and say, wow, you know, that whole thing was fine. But then when he told me about this feature, this new thing, I could go and use that right away. So I spend the whole talk trying to show you cool stuff in hope that one of those things will be the one that will make you go, ah, now that's useful. The rest of that was garbage, but that is useful. Maybe OmniSharp is one of those things. OmniSharp is an open source project that takes the aspects of modularity of the .NET framework and makes IntelliSense available on other platforms and on other editors. So we all know how IntelliSense works, and we all know how Visual Studio works. But what if I went into Sublime? Anyone use Sublime Text? Yeah? So on Sublime, I might be editing my ASP.NET application. And we all know with Sublime, when you start typing, and then you start typing again, and it auto-completes. That's not IntelliSense. That's, I saw you type that before. Right? Especially if you type something really long. But if you can host Roslyn, the compiler, out of process and have something communicate to it as I'm typing in this text editor and hit dot, I could have IntelliSense in Sublime. That's what OmniSharp enables. So let me give you a proof. Var I equals Scott. I'm not going to hit save. I'm just typing. I dot. Those are string things. I'm going to change Scott to an int. Those are int things. So what's happening? This is what's so cool. I think it's good to show people what's inside the plumbing. Check this out. See in the corner there? As we're typing, we're actually making a web service call locally to a hosted version of Roslyn. Yeah, his jaw just dropped, which makes me happy. This is another thing, a little tip. If you ever do speaking like this, there's like 1,000 people in the room, but I have to look for a couple of people because you're all being very quiet right now. There's been no applause of any kind. I don't even know if you're awake, right? But no, I don't want your pity applause. Wait for it to really matter. But now this gentleman here, he just went like naturally, like he was actually impressed, right? So I've been doing this for now 30 minutes, and it took 30 minutes to get that. So now you all disappear. You see how that works? And now it's just me and him, because like at least he had a good time. It's a really common technique when you're teaching classes, or I used to teach college, and I would just look around until somebody got it, and then I would just stare at that person for the rest of the talk, because at least we're good. The rest of you all suck, but we're cool. So there is a little process, a little hosted web API right there. Cool. That lets you do that. And as we're typing, we're asking it for autocomplete, and it's giving it. See that about? See that right there? See it just go by? See? So if that's modular and that's open source, where else could we do it? Well, we can do it in Sublime. We can do it in brackets. We can do it in Vim or Emacs, because there's always one person in this room who's using Emacs, right? They're like, Emacs people are like CrossFit. They will tell you before they even tell you their name, right? Hey, how's it going? You know I use Emacs and I'm a vegan and I browse the web with JavaScript disabled. And then, you know, I don't even own a television. Hate those people. I have a copy of Emacs, but it's actually running at home. I can't exit it. It's been running for a couple of years. Pretty soon, I'm going to be able to exit it. So that's Sublime, but who is using Visual Studio Code? Any Visual Studio Code people here? Cool. Visual Studio Code. Ooh, Visual Studio Code wants to update itself. That's cool. Let's do that. That won't be risky at all. Huh? To just take an automatic update right here, right? Maybe I should just run Windows Update and see how that works out for me. Nothing bad ever happened after a Windows Update. All right. If this works, man. So check this out. See that little flame right there? That's the OmniSharp symbol. That's the OmniSharp flame. So here I am inside of Visual Studio Code. It's using the same thing. So whether it's Vim or Emacs or Brackets or Atom or Visual Studio Code, you're getting that same introspection from Roslyn. What's cool about this also is that you can get these little guys, right? Refactorings. I can go and do rename symbol. So I can do refactorings, and the refactorings are then sent off to that out of process thing and then back. What's nice about this is that it runs on Mac, it runs on Linux, it runs on Windows. So now you can pick the editor that makes you happy, use the language that makes you happy, and do C# and ASP.NET on whatever editor and whatever operating system that you want. So then people start to wonder, well, why is Microsoft doing this, right? How are you going to make any money? This is my opinion. This is not official Microsoft marketing. That way, in case I get fired for saying it, you know that it was just me. Is that what's Microsoft trying to sell you now, right? Before they try to sell you Windows. But now Microsoft wants to sell you Windows, Office, Xbox, and Azure, right? if you don't have a Windows phone, maybe you have an iPhone, maybe you'll run Office on the thing. Maybe you don't want to use ASP.NET. Maybe you'll use Node, but you'll do it in Azure, because we think Azure is a really great thing. We want to have a Mac person using the editor that makes them happy, hopefully using ASP.NET because it makes them happy, hopefully putting it in Azure, hopefully because it makes them happy. Because reality is a hybrid, isn't it? Reality is a hybrid. Reality is me with an iPhone running Office with a Microsoft foldable Bluetooth keyboard that also talks to my Android tablet, and then working on those things together, right? And then deploying something off to the cloud. Reality isn't running all Microsoft stuff all the time. And I think the realization of that is enabling cool scenarios like this. So let's switch back to Visual Studio over here. And this particular application is an ASP.NET app, and it's using MVC. And you notice that these are all NuGet packages, right? They're all coming from the NuGet, N-U-G-E-T, the NuGet source for all libraries. Notice that in DNX, though, let me zoom in here again. Excuse me. When we go all the way down, we'll eventually hit framework assemblies. You see that? That's because those assemblies are in Windows. But if I did the same thing in .NET Core, it would go all the way down to system dot, and system dot is a NuGet package. All of this is NuGet packages. In fact, if I go and look in this folder here, this isn't C colon Windows, is it? Right? This is C users .NET execution framework here, and there's a list of runtimes here. I can go out to the command line, and I can type .NET version manager and list out all the different versions of the .NET framework that I have on this machine. I could even accidentally delete some. Oops. So I just deleted two versions of the .NET framework. Now I can hit Control Z and undelete them. And now they're back. Because I don't have to be afraid of the .NET framework anymore, because it's just sitting in a folder somewhere. And that means that when two people work at the same company and they deploy to the same machine, they don't have to worry about their versions of stuff breaking the other person's machine. With the full framework, sometimes there's some concern. You know, he might have .NET 4.5, she wants to use 4.6. They have to come up with a way to deploy to the same machine. They can't do that today. But with the .NET Core framework, they could. But something else that's interesting here is that some of these frameworks are not Windows. I actually brought in Darwin. Darwin is the code name for Mac OS, right? So in this case here, I've got beta 7 for Darwin on this machine, and I could then package up a project. I could say .NET utilities publish, and then say dash dash runtime, and then publish from a Windows machine this ASP.NET application onto a Mac. So I went and did that as I was standing up here with Richard. I've got a USB key here. And web output beta 7. So here is the ASP.NET application. There's the source, there's the web app, and there's all the stuff, right? The startup.cs, okay? But look here under runtimes, it says core-clr-darwin. So I need someone to give me their Macintosh and give it to me. Do you need that Mac? You do, actually. He doesn't want to give it to me. He's got stuff we don't want to see. Anyone, give me a Mac. Seriously, you're going to ruin the whole talk if I don't get a Mac. Someone bring me a Macintosh right now. No one else? Seriously, 1,000 people in the room and no one has a Mac? I don't believe that for a second. Do you have a Mac? All right, come up here. This guy is going to hook me up. You're like not running like System 7 or something. You have like an actual modern Mac. Can you log into it, or do I need to do anything? Just opens it? Is that how Macs work now? All right. I'm just going to minimize everything here. So I'm taking this guy's Mac, and how does this thing work? I'm gonna plug this thing in here, and I'm gonna take my USB key. There you go, that looks Mac-ish. And then I think that goes over here. Do you think that font could be smaller? Yeah, I blame you. This is Chris's Mac, everybody, so big thanks to Chris for ruining my talk with his tiny font. What's wrong with you, Chris? Who does that? So you can see this is blinking right here. Whoops. So here is a incognito mode. And localhost 5000. And this is, wait for it, because it's running off a USB key, and a crappy one too. I need to get USB 3, I hear that's the new hotness. Maybe it's just a really slow Mac. How do you like that, Chris? Is this a slow Mac? Is that what's going on here? Or it's not on port 5000. It got that far. The pressure's on now, because I like took the guy's Mac and everything. Look at me using hotkeys on a Mac. Isn't that crazy? Okay. Oops. Blink, 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 blink. You don't have any beta stuff on this. You don't have any of the things. This is just a regular Mac doing regular Mac stuff, right? Maybe I need to use IE6. If I wanted to hurt Chris, I would push that button. Well, that's kind of weird, Chris. What's wrong with you? Yeah. There's a virtual machine spun up. Well, now you tell me. What do you got? What's going on your computer, Chris? Let's bring up the dashboard for Macintosh. This may be the first time that this... I just broke something. What does RM-F do on this? You've ruined me, Chris. This is the first time this has never worked, so clearly the only solution is to turn off the Wi-Fi. Try one more time. Ah, it worked! I don't know, maybe it was a hotel Wi-Fi thing. Actually, that probably was it. So I was noticing that the title bar loaded, but nothing else was loading. So I'm going to use my Sherlock Holmes brain and say that it was probably trying to get the CSS and the images from a CDN. And it couldn't get that because hotel Wi-Fi. So then I turned off the Wi-Fi and it immediately came up. So this is an ASP.NET 5 application running on a random dude's Macintosh. And now I'm gonna pull this out, and now it's still running, and I don't know what state this is gonna leave him in, but he's probably screwed. So good luck with that, sir. So that's kind of a cool demo. That's one of those, are they really going to cut that guy in half kind of Las Vegas demos, you know what I mean? Like, he really did it. He really cut that guy in half. That was awesome. But that wasn't hard enough. Like, if I'm going to do a demo, it's got to be really risky and probably not work. So let's do, where's that other mouse? That's a mouse. This is a mouse. Let's do this. Give me AV guy, put me on one. Do I show up there? This is a Raspberry Pi. Is that a bald spot? Oh my God. So here's a Raspberry Pi, and I just realized that I didn't put a monitor anywhere. So I will go over here. I'll bring my keyboard with me, because I can't see anything. So let's bring up terminal and let's ls and let's go into dev and let's go into home and samples. This is a little bit older version of what we were doing. This is before we switched over to DNX. Let's go hello MVC. Kestrel. No? I can never remember how to do this. All right, and let's bring up this whatever browser this is, some kind of random Raspberry Pi looking browser deal. Oops. Is that the refreshy button over there? I can't see. There it is. There we go. And there's ASP.NET running on a Raspberry Pi. So we want it to work everywhere. We want it to be modular. Damien actually has a version of this running on Windows 10 on a Raspberry Pi. This is running Raspbian, which is their custom Linux distribution. But the point I'm making to you is that we want you to be able to do with whatever makes you happy. And the choice is the reason. Why would you want this on a Raspberry Pi? Well, maybe you're an ASP.NET person by day, you're having fun doing maker type stuff at night, and you want to go and make a little project with a Raspberry Pi, and you want to use a language that you understand. So you could see hooking up a sensor to a Raspberry Pi and then making a web API, call it. I'm working on one right now that will text me when I leave the garage door open. So I take the Raspberry Pi and I tape it to my garage door. And then when the garage door goes up and then rotates, I keep track of the orientation. And if it's upside down for more than 5 minutes, it texts me and says, you left the garage door open. And then the next step will be to make a web API to close the garage door. Just stupid stuff like that. Now, I know I could do that in any language, but it makes me happy that I can potentially do that in the language that I like. So let's switch back over to the Windows machine. Thank you. Now, remember, I was talking about choice, but I also want to talk about the ability to debug. And I'm going to try to do in more and more increasingly difficult demos that probably won't work. So this probably won't work, so just lower your expectation now that it's just going to fail. What, do you want me to do a specific thing to fail? What's the bald spot? Is it getting worse? It's getting bad during demos. Oh, God, see, it's stress. It's stress. It's making me lose my hair. I'm glad that you noticed it. You're not really one to talk, though, so. Yeah. So. He does a lot of demos, yeah, I understand. So MVC, in this case here, is coming from a NuGet package, but it's also open source, right? How often have you found yourself using an open source library, whether it be MVC or JSON.NET or something else, and you wanted to debug into that? You wanted to be able to debug that. Well, what I did is I brought down MVC. I just went to the MVC repo and cloned it. Okay, and this is MVC beta 8. You can see I'm down here in my Git prompt, and you see that I've checked out that tag because they need to line up. I'm running beta 8 in Visual Studio. I'm running beta 8 in my MVC repository. I'm going to go back over to Visual Studio, and I'm going to edit this thing called the global.json. This says, where do I look for my files? Right now, it looks in source and in test for the files that make up my project. But I want to add C GitHub MVC source. Okay. Now, I just hit save, and look what's going on. It immediately freaked out. Something's going on over here. And I'm going to go and say restore packages. Oop, look what's happening. It just saw that MVC is sitting over there. And now it's bringing him in. I didn't have to load any C-sharp project. It just saw, it just noticed that. So now, here's all of MVC. And now look what happened to these here. They are now not a NuGet reference. They are a class reference. Does that make sense? You like that? So if I look at my project JSON file where all my references are for web application, whatever this is called, you can see here are my references, right? They call them dependencies in this document. Notice on line 18, it just says, I want Microsoft.ASP.NET.MVC beta 8. It doesn't say this NuGet package. It doesn't say this website. It just says, get me beta 8. And because it found beta 8 in a folder instead of up in the cloud, the local folder overrode the one that was in the cloud. These references here often refer to NuGets, right? I can go here and start typing, and then I'll get IntelliSense on from what's coming from NuGet. But they can also be local references. Like if I had a class library, I might say class library 1. So simply by bringing the source down and having the source correct, having it lined up, I can now debug that. But it's not just about debugging. What if I needed to fix a bug in ASP.NET and I needed to go to production right now? Well, in the past, that could be a huge problem. You couldn't go to production. But here, I could package up my own personal build of MVC and I could ship that. And then he would have his own personal private build of MVC on his own personal private build of Roslyn, maybe, of .NET Core. But he puts it on the same machine as what she was using, where you know she's going to be on a different version or on the main line, but they don't affect each other. Let me show you a really cool visual way to think about that. I apologize ahead of time to any of the vegans or CrossFitters in the room because this does use steak as an analogy. So you know when you have steak, there's like well done, okay? Well done is just use Visual Studio and use the stuff on NuGet. That's your most boring, most basic, safe. You're not going to get salmonella, probably, if you use Visual Studio. That's our new marketing thing. You won't get salmonella if you use Visual Studio. I think it's going to hit it. It's going to be really popular. You could go medium well, start using our betas, our CTPs, right? Technology previews. You could go medium, a little bit of pink. You want a little pink? Those are continuous integration drops, like nightly builds, CI drops. You could use MyGet. A lot of people don't know about MyGet. It's a wonderful tool. If you have NuGet at your work, you use NuGet, but you want to filter it, or you want to have your own NuGet server, you could run one locally, or you could go to MyGet, and they will make you a NuGet in the cloud, and your company could have your own personal MyGet. We use this for ASP.NET. That's medium. Now, medium rare, building from source, that's what I just did. Or maybe going off of a dev branch. Probably not super risky, but you're definitely not well done anymore. And then rare, feature branches. Like there's a specific feature that you want to use and someone is branched and you have a favorite programmer at Microsoft and you're watching them do their work. Now here's something that I learned about because I prefer medium rare myself. Did you know that there is a kind of meat that is called blue? This is when you just smack the cow on the butt and send it out, and a good doctor could still bring it back. This is a thing. People like this. So apparently, if you want to go before rare, you can go and build from third-party forks, right? I could actually use someone else's source code if someone decides to go and fork ASP.NET. But remember at the very, very beginning of the talk, we talked about risk, we talked about open source, what it means to an enterprise. If you stay at well done, you'll be fine. That's what the enterprise typically will do. But maybe if you're working on something, you might try a beta if you have a little bit more tolerance for risk. But if you're doing a project that's just really way out there or you want to, you can go and do something as rare or blue. The point here again is choice. You get to do what makes you happy. If there's a thing about ASP.NET you don't like, swap it out. If you don't like the source, change it. If you want to pull an entire subsystem out, even if you want to replace the yellow screen of death, right, the error page, you can actually replace that now as well. So it's an unprecedented amount of flexibility. The last thing I want to show you is, oops, looks like I fell off the internet here. The last thing I want to show you is this thing called docs.asp.net. Not only is our code open source, but in fact our documentation is as well. And it's being written in a markdown-like language called restructured text. And you can go up here, and if you, you know, you maybe you have a Mac at home, and you want to install it on a Mac, you can go in there and go step by step. We'll teach you how to install stuff. We are doing all of this in the open, so things that are not yet finished have a little wrench by them. So if you want to help out, you can go and say, well, gosh, this has a mistake in it. I'm going to go and edit this on GitHub. And this could be maybe your first contribution to open source. You could check, you know, change some spelling. You could fix some spelling on one of our docs, and then on your resume, you could say, avid Microsoft open source contributor. And it'll be totally awesome. No one will ever question you. In fact, I'm trying to promote a new idea, because I think more people should get into open source, and it's called firsttimersonly.com. And this is an opportunity for a lot of you who have been thinking about doing open source, but you maybe were afraid, because it's a lot of intensity to think about getting into open source. It's a lot of potential risk. We're going to think about marking certain features, certain things, as being first-timer-only friendly. Marking an issue in the repository such that if this is the first time you've ever done open source, then we will help you through it a little bit. Because there's a lot of fear that you're going to go and do a pull request and you're going to get a response like, you suck! And then you'll never do open source again. Or, you know, how dare you? You made a mistake. Blah. And then people get turned off. We actually went and we asked folks on Twitter what their first experience was like doing open source. Some loved it. Some felt welcomed. This guy jumped around the office for an hour. But other people said that they didn't understand the contribution rules. The remarks were negative, and then they felt hostile. I don't want people to feel like that when they're doing open source, and certainly not on Microsoft. So if you, someone in the audience, does open source, and you have an open source project, I would encourage you to tag issues as first timers only, and then be sensitive to when people start and get involved in open source. And we're going to try to do the same thing at Microsoft with ASP.NET. And then the last little pitch here is I've got a website called getinvolvedintech.com. And it's a free movie. It's actually a 2-hour-long documentary that Rob Connery and I created. And we made a deal with Pluralsight. Pluralsight's like Netflix for programmers. And it's free. You don't have to sign in to Pluralsight. And I go through with with Rob, and we talk about how to make a Twitter, how to use Stack Overflow, how to make a blog, how to do GitHub, all of the kinds of things that are going to get you started in being a social developer, because ASP.NET is going this way. .NET is going this way. I think Microsoft is going this way, and I think that this is an opportunity for us, Microsoft developers, to learn from the good stuff and the bad stuff that has happened in the other communities, in the other open source communities, and do the very best we can to have an open and inclusive and representative group of people doing a lot of great code and a lot of great work in open source in .NET. So check that out. That's getinvolvedintech.com. And I think that is my talk. So thank you very much for your time.